Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air. I am Jim Grant, and with me, as always, is Evan Lorenz, the great deputy editor of Grant's. Harrison Wadil is the control panel, and Matt McLennan, the co-head of Global Value Team and portfolio manager at First Eagle here in New York, is with us. Matt, I happen to know, is the first guest of our podcast, now about 8 years old, who was born in Rabaul, Papua New Guinea. So, Right, Evan?
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, we did a search earlier, and you win that prize. And also, I think, among his many financial accomplishments, I'm not going to bore, or I'm not going to embarrass him or belabor the listening audience. Suffice it to say that he is a bold-faced guy in Wall Street, meaning only top-flight names. But what strikes one also is that Matt is a board member of the Library America, so he is a man of considerable breadth of interest, and I dare say of erudition. So, Matt, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So this is like an ordinary day, right, Evan? You know, so things open up around 2 or 3% down in the morning, and up around
8-9%.
Was that because someone blinked?
Well, it was kind of a blink and a bit of a smirk. So Trump paused his supersized tariffs on most of the world. Most of the world will now face a 10% tariff rate versus much lower rates before. And he's increased the rate on China to 125%. That's 125%.
Yeah. Well, the readers of Grants will soon see this for themselves. But we have every issue we have a cartoon. And if the world is treating us right, the cartoon is going to be thematic. And the cartoon on the front page of this issue is a picture of the White House, a drawing of the White House. And over it is Jules Feiffer. Remember him? He's a cartoonist who gave quotations emanating from buildings, clearly identifiable buildings. Also, this is the White House. And the quoted words coming from the White House is, "Le monde, c'est moi." Not merely l'état, le monde, c'est moi. Oh, who said that in this podcast? Anyway, it's never a dull moment. And Matt, before we get any further, I want to ask you how the heck you are investing in this particular environment.
Like any environment, I think you have to let price be your guide. That's the objective part of investing. And, you know, when you deploy capital into a business, you know, you have to think first and foremost about the scarcity of the market position of the underlying company. And I think when you see wild swings like this and the market is prognosticating over the top-down macro, it opens up possibilities for the inquiring bottom-up manager. But I think putting aside the focus on just a measured approach to capital allocation, bottom-up, one security at a time, I think we find ourselves in a situation like the one we do with these kinds of massive intraday movements because, you know, we entered this year with very low risk perception in markets, yet a fundamental backdrop that was suggestive of quite a bit of prospective risk. And, I think most importantly, we entered with an economy that was not below trend. I mean, 4% unemployment is low relative to history, and wage inflation, even though it's come down from its high levels, was still high relative to history. We had very easy financial conditions and expectations of growing earnings. And at the same time, 7% plus budget deficits. And I think when you've got an asymmetry between the fiscal position and the real economy, it feels good in the rear vision mirror, but prospectively, it presents risks. And, I think in order to kind of navigate the environment, you have to understand that if they did nothing on the fiscal adjustment side, then in all likelihood, you could see payrolls and wages pick up again and more inflation than the market was expecting. And when they tried some form of fiscal consolidation, albeit debatable the form thereof, markets tanked and started to price recession risk. And so you're caught in this very tough bind when you think about the U.S. top-down with policymakers having to choose between inflation or recession because of our fiscal settings. And I think that makes the investing exercise more challenging But I think it doesn't take away from the basic need to keep focused on price and the quality of the underlying business.
So, Matt, what do you do all day? I mean, you're the co-head of the Global Value team, and you're a portfolio manager of the Global Value, Global Equity, International Value, International Equity, and U.S. Value Strategies at First Eagle. And that entails the picking of stocks, right? The macro stuff is it for water cooler consideration? And the stock picking is foremost?
Yeah, we major in buying interests in business, but I guess we minor in having some degree of macro awareness. As Jean-Marie always used to say at First Eagle, it's worth having a wary eye to what can go wrong. And I think you can't ignore the macro, but at the end of the day, the rubber meets the road at the bottom-up stock selection side. And you know what we spend our time doing during the day is a lot of reading, a lot of discussions, talking about businesses one at a time, and reflecting on what we're seeing in the outside world. And I guess I would describe it as aggressive reflection and selective action.
Matt, you're a value investor and quite a good one. And part of value investing is the belief in the continuity of the world and businesses. So a business that is temporarily under-earning might go back to the historical return on capital employed that it earned over the long span of its history. It kind of feels from what you described and what we're seeing today that we're in a period of discontinuity. The fiscal deficit may be unsustainable, and if it comes down, it could have pretty big repercussions for the economy. Trump is putting swinging tariffs on, taking them off, putting them back on. These are all things that are jumping around and have wild implications for business values and business earnings. How does somebody who, I mean, value investing at its basis is basically, you know, reversion to the mean. How do you deal with a discontinuous world?
It's such a great question. And I think the key thought I would share with you on this is that it places much more of a premium on identifying businesses that have some kind of advantage in the incumbency of their market position, because the greater the extent to which one's getting whipped around by macro policy, the more a company needs to be in charge of its own destiny. And so that implies that, you know, you want to be trying to identify companies that have some kind of advantage, whether it's in the physical, tangible assets they hold. You know, they might be well located on a cash cost curve if they're in the extractive resources industry, or they might have the best centrally located property if they're in real estate. Or they need some advantage in their intangible assets. And what do I mean by that? Essentially, what we look for before we even think about price is businesses that have some kind of market share scale advantage, typically that's been sticky, stable over time. And that might be because they are a holding company for iconic brands that have survived the test of time, or it might be because they've mastered a precision process for manufacturing a certain type of good that's given them scale and R&D and scale and distribution. Or it might be that they have network density in terms of the markets they serve. And the reason I mention all of this is that companies that either have scarce real assets or scarce intangible assets, they're not going to be immune to the whipsaw of macro policy and business cycles that come and go, but they will have a degree of staying power and persistence. And so I think if you're going to think about capitalizing an earnings stream and thinking about mean reversion, I think it pays in an environment like this where there is discontinuity risk to focus on businesses that are more likely than not to persist. And I'd say the second thing is to be open-minded to diversification. I think it's become a little bit of a focus of the investment management industry to be as concentrated as possible as a reflection of one's conviction. But I think you only have to look at the events of the last day or so to remind yourself of the power of humility in investing, of knowing that you don't know everything. And if you think that we're in a discontinuous world, that implies that the world is not going to be normally distributed. It's going to have fatter tails. And that means that you should be more open-minded to diversification, across industries, across countries. In addition to focusing on the quality of a company's market position, I think those two things can provide some amount of ballast. And of course, you know, we've held a potential hedge in gold as well, which we can talk about later. But I think it's, you know, the way we deal with discontinuity risk is through the nature of the businesses we focus on, through our, I guess our, the endorsement of humility is an important pillar of temperament of investing, and the willingness to diversify, and then, you know, having some ballast as a potential hedge in gold.
We would definitely like to talk about gold, but to make it tangible for our listeners, can you talk to us about one of these businesses with those scarce resources, whether physical or intangible, that you had on and you did not lose sleep on during the week when Trump was putting on these gigantic tariffs and perhaps taking them off?
So there are a range of businesses like that I think will hopefully bring it to life, and some of them more eclectic than others. But, you know, in the realm of intangible assets, we talked about companies that own iconic brands, and one of those may be as simple as a company that everyone's heard of, Unilever, for example, which is you know, the owner of various iconic brands from Dove soap to Axe deodorant, Hellmann's mayonnaise. This is a company that's present in many countries around the world, sells affordable staples, has strong market share positions in the categories in which it competes, and which is priced with a margin of safety. You know, you're talking about a company with a 6% free cash flow yield, which is a tantamount to a real yield, given the ability of the business to grow in line with nominal activity over time. And so that's an example of a company that might have iconic brands. But it also mentioned precision processes. And sometimes these businesses can be fairly eclectic. And an example of one that we've held in our funds has been a Japanese company called Hoshizaki, which is the world leader in ice machines for commercial locations. So if you go to a restaurant or a football stadium or a hospital, more likely than not, the ice machine will be made by Hoshizaki. And again, it's a company that will go through its cycles for its equipment, and certainly COVID was difficult for the restaurant equipment industry, but where people, whoever owns the restaurant, whoever is running the hospital or the stadium, does need a commercial kitchen equipment that works. And Hoshizaki is a leader in this field. They have sales force density that's unparalleled in their key markets, and they have net cash on the balance sheet. So we don't have to worry about the business getting into financial trouble, given that it doesn't employ debt in its day-to-day operations. And then there are other companies that have sort of more real assets and maybe provide some diversification benefit. And so while many of our real estate investments in the Global Fund could be in the United States or in Europe, we've also been willing to entertain some select investments in Hong Kong, for example, and we've had a stake in Hong Kong Land, incidentally listed in Singapore, but the headquarters in Hong Kong and corporate domiciles in Bermuda, part of the Jardine Matheson Group itself, which has survived many different kinds of regimes, but they own arguably the best portfolio of central city Hong Kong real estate. Commercial, retail, residential, and you have a company that has a fairly low payout ratio, but it's got a 6% or so dividend yield, committed to doubling its dividend over the next handful of years with a very conservative balance sheet. And so in a market that's already gone through quite a bit of distress and where you're getting look-through cap rates that are nearly double digit, when private market transactions have been closer to 3% cap rates. So those are some examples of businesses that you may have heard of or may not have heard of that, you know, in the context of a diversified portfolio make sense to us.
Matt, what valuations are you comfortable with, and what valuation thresholds are you not prepared to go through?
It's a great question. You know, ultimately, it depends on the nature of the business. And if you could imagine a spectrum of businesses from the most mundane business that's in a competitive industry, you know, because you don't have in a competitive industry the ability to to really grow materially and intrinsic value through reinvestment, the business should never be worth much more than the complement of its cost of capital. So if it has an 8% cost of capital, it shouldn't be worth much more than 12 times earnings. And that's probably 6 or 7 times EBITDA, although we focus more on EBIT than EBITDA, because DA is an expense. On the other hand, you know, if you're a company that controls your own destiny and has a very strong and sticky market share position and can grow at 4 or 5% a year in line with nominal GDP globally without having to deploy a lot more capital, then in order to generate an 8% cost of capital, you could trade at a lower earnings yield. You could be worth 20 or 25 times earnings. Of course, we wouldn't look to pay that valuation. But conceptually, there's a spectrum, Jim, from companies that are competitive and just earn their cost of capital to companies that are more franchise-like or more like eclectic royalties on nominal GDP, where the return is going to be split between the free cash flow yield and the positive drift in intrinsic value, kind of like the concentric circles or tree rings, if you will, that you'd observe in nature. And so typically that means, given our preference for businesses that have something special about their market position, you know, our desire is usually to buy into a business at 5, 6, 7% unlevered free cash flow yields. We're not really paying much for growth in real terms. We get that optionality for free. And those businesses theoretically could be worth north of 20 times earnings. But we, you know, we particularly like businesses that are sometimes outside of the focus of the market because they rarely attract massive valuation premiums. And you can just let them compound over time patiently.
Despite all of the volatility, including upside volatility today, the S&P 500 is still down year to date. However, looking at the multiple of the market, it's over 32 times its cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, a level that historically has been more on par with the dot-com bubble and kind of the everything bubble in 2021. In this sell-off, have you found much to do to put your money to work, or are there any babies that have been thrown out of the bathwater, or does, you know, 10 or 15% less expensive of something that is very expensive still not kind of cross your threshold?
In general terms, if I think back to the last few days, we've allocated capital in what I would refer to as a measured way. To your point, we essentially moved from expensive valuations to more normal valuations. And that is, to your point, without any kind of look back cyclical adjustment. My sense is stocks are probably a little less expensive than the cyclically adjusted metric that you suggested. For one particular reason, and that is that the nominal high watermark of the U.S. economy has been expanding at a faster rate the last few years than it did for much of the post-war period, because we've been running larger fiscal deficits. So we've been growing the stock of government debt or the level of government debt at a faster clip the last decade than we have for the prior 5 or 6 decades. In fact, you know, from 1945 to plus or minus 2005, the government, excluding interest expense, was pretty much in primary balance. And the deficits in the last 20 years have been on a structural downtrend, which means that the level of government debt is growing faster. And what is government debt other than a promise to print more money in the future? And unsurprisingly, at the level of earnings of the S&P 500, and the level of the S&P 500 itself has sort of drifted higher with that stock of government debt. And so it may be the fact that the cyclically adjusted measures, and I think you're referring to the Shiller PE, may not be fully capturing the acceleration and the nominal drift of the economy. But putting that aside, the stock market today after its rally is still trading at 20 times this year's expected earnings, which would represent a new high watermark for earnings for the S&P 500. So it's hard to make the argument that stocks are distressed or depressed at 20 times earnings. However, one thing I will say is that our universe is just not limited to the U.S. You know, we're able to look at markets around the world. And if you look at European stocks or UK stocks, they're more in the 10 to 12 times earnings range.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about American exceptionalism, Matt, as it pertains to security selection and how you deal with the unusual, if not unique, valuation of the United States with respect to the world's valuation. People have spun all manner of theories about why this country ought to be in the vanguard, not of of PE multiples, right? We ought to be the leader in PE multiples. And in the past couple of weeks, a lot of the turmoil has seemed to change that narrative. So are you finding much more to do abroad?
It's such a good question. And, you know, it just reminds me of the basic premise that to make money in investing, there has to be some asymmetry between price and prospects. And, you know, the problem that the US market encountered this year is that, you know, coming into the year and at its peak, the market was not at 20 times earnings, closer to 25 times earnings. You know, if you invert that, that's a 4% earnings yield. And I mentioned Europe before was closer to 12 times earnings or about an 8% earnings yield. Now, so you could make arguments about American exceptionalism, but you'd find very few economists who would predict a 4% differential in the real growth rate of America versus Europe. You know, the productivity differential might be a point, point and a half. And so the earnings yield gap between the U.S. and the rest of the world was a lot larger than what you would reasonably think of as the productivity differential. And then there's other parts of the world, the emerging market complex, that may have the ability to play catch up over time and grow at least as fast as the U.S. that were also only trading at low double-digit multiples. And so I would make the argument that the perception of American exceptionalism was well priced. And I think in part because the U.S. had amongst the easiest fiscal policy. And if you were to do a mental experiment, if you had a closed economy and you started running big budget deficits, it would produce a surplus in the private corporate sector. So perhaps margins in the U.S. were better than expected and looked more resilient because of easy fiscal policy. That can't carry on forever, as we discussed before. And so, you know, I think that one has to be open-minded to looking around the world. And in fact, it's a very simple observation, but the U.S. is a great country, great economy, but it doesn't have a monopoly on good businesses.
I wanted to have a word from our sponsor. This edition of Current Yield is sponsored by, you know, by us, in particular, by something great that's going to happen in Manhattan on Tuesday, April 29th, and that's the Grants Distressed Investing event. It's a half day, and the theme is, you know, how do you make some money out of a troubled world? And goodness knows there are troubles, and likewise, symmetrically, there are opportunities. And I'm going to give you a sense of what's going to happen on this half day, chock-a-block full of smart people with good, actionable ideas about investing in a time of latent or looming stress. All right, here goes. So, I, Jim Grant, and the topic of my remarks are comeuppance for the public credit of the United States. And James Bray Regan is one of the foremost, if not the foremost, bankruptcy attorneys in America. And he's going to ask, where are we in the distress cycle? Where are we going? Carrie Findling, who makes a living by lending to companies that perhaps nobody who's looking only at public companies has heard of. She invests in closely held businesses and has done a phenomenal job of doing that. We'll talk to her about how that business is going to fare come a time of distress. Marty Hale, from Jeff Bezos to Wang to Graham and Dodd, by capitalizing on the volatility of value and valuation in tech stocks. My goodness, it goes from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves, even with some of the very best known names, one or two in the Mag 7. And he's going to tell you how you can get them at deep discounts during the course of their investment careers, yours and the company's. Joseph Heller, on disrupted, transitioning, and complex companies. Vic Appel on commercial real estate, Sean Goldsmith on the changing tastes and macroeconomic troubles that spell opportunity in the specific business of the zero-proof adult beverage business. He's going to talk about how the interest rate suppression of the past several years and many years caused a misallocation of capital that is now coining opportunities in the zero-proof adult beverage business. David Nemechek is the dean of the so-called liability management exercise line of borrower strategizing in the corporate world. We'll hear from him how companies squirm out of the debts they owe. And finally, Tony Yusilov, opportunistic plays in public and private credit at home and abroad. So that's April 29th, the Grants Distress Investing event. Eminently affordable. Go on our website, grantspub.com, and just be there. All right? Simple as that.
Matt, if I'm not mistaken, the First Eagle Global Fund holds an 11.9% position in gold. And if you include gold miners, its gold-related investments is 15.1%. And I believe you're not a Johnny-come-lately to actually the gold bandwagon. Could you talk to us about how you think about gold as a part of a portfolio and how you think about it in terms of protecting the downside and portfolio construction?
I'd be happy to. And I think when most people approach the topic of gold, they almost do so with a very binary mindset. They say, why do you own gold? Are you a miser, or are you a prepper thinking the world is coming to an end? And I'm like, this is the wrong way to look at it. The better way is to almost draw an analogy and say, you know, think of a bank. What constitutes a good bank? A good bank has, on the one hand, the ability to make good underwriting decisions, to make sound loans, to take selective risk that's being compensated. But on the other hand, it has a strong capital position, a strong Tier 1 capital, for example. And so good banks embody the duality of investment risk and capital. And I view it the same from a portfolio construction for us, that gold is essentially defensive land. It comes from the land, and it's a natural element that is chemically inert, therefore has a lower risk character than things that are chemically useful like iron ore or copper or aluminum. It's a naturally defensive element. It happens to be very dense, and density and scarcity are correlated on the periodic table. So it's scarce, defensive, malleable land. And so people say, well, what value does something have that doesn't have a cash flow stream? I'm like, it has positional value. I don't think people would argue whether a vacant block of land in Palm Beach or in Mayfair in London had value. They can see that land has positional value. Some part of nominal wealth would be used to buy that. And gold is very much the same, because there are no substitutes for it on the periodic table. And I think over thousands of years, people have iterated towards the use of gold as a defensive real asset. And so we think it has its characteristics by virtue of its chemical composition. And over the last 50 plus years, treasuries, because we couldn't handle the discipline of gold as money, have provided cash flow yields. But the yield has been less than the growth in money supply and less than the cumulative growth in the stock of debt. So it's almost like a stock that's paying a dividend yield less than the rate at which shares are growing. Not a great deal. On the other hand, gold has had no yield, but its equilibrium value has compounded out in excess of money supply growth and has kept pace with the supply growth of government debt. And so gold has had positional value, and I think many people confuse that. And so when we think about it from a portfolio standpoint, we don't try to make a decision that you should just all own gold or all own equities. We are primarily investors in equities, and we realize, given our concerns about the financial architecture and the kind of discontinuity risk, to use your phrase from before, that we want some part of our portfolio in more defensive capital, in a potential hedge. And gold represents that par excellence. And in terms of the sizing of it in our portfolios, we don't want to be too scientific. You know, a good bank will have a low double-digit percentage in its capital. You know, we have a low double-digit percentage to mid-teens percentage in gold bullion and gold miners. The reality is that if gold continues to appreciate and stocks depreciate, we would naturally recycle some of that gold into the ownership of businesses on very advantageous terms to stop the position size of gold being outsized. On the other hand, in environments that have been far more speculative, where gold has been depressed, we've been willing to trim some of our stocks that have become overvalued and buy some gold as deferred purchasing power for the future. And so at the margin, we've trimmed a little gold here and there so that it doesn't become outsized, but we see it existing as a complementary part of our portfolio to the business risk that we take elsewhere.
Matt, if some clairvoyant could materialize at your offices at First Eagle and tell you there's a recession coming, and it'll begin in June, and it'll last 9 months, and it'll take the GDP down 2% and create some difficulty in the world of credit, would you do anything different with your portfolio?
Well, I guess there's the presumption that one trusts the clairvoyant. You know, we've always had a belief.
Well, you're a reader of Grants, right?
Yeah. We always say that our crystal ball is foggy at best, and I fundamentally am a believer in the uncertainty of markets. And so, but putting aside those philosophical leanings about the impossibility of clairvoyance, were one to be predicting a recession with certainty, I don't think it would change a lot of what we do because, you know, our average holding period for a stock investment is close to a decade. We've held the gold for a very long time. So I guess we've built a portfolio that's intended to navigate the ups and downs of the business cycle. You know, if I knew for sure that there was a recession coming and there were certain securities in the portfolio that weren't pricing any recession risk, you know, and I really believed in the clairvoyant, maybe I'd lighten up a little and wait patiently and redeploy the capital. But I think, you know, the beauty of knowing what you're looking for in terms of the type of business and the type of price point is that you don't have to predict the future. You can simply take advantage of market moves after they occur. So if we get the recession and stocks are down another 10 or 20%, you know, then we'll have the opportunity to sell some of our more defensive businesses, maybe use some of our gold, some of our cash to buy great but cyclical businesses at very depressed prices. On the other hand, if we bounce back to the appearance of prosperity and expensive markets, we might do the opposite. We may trim some holdings that become very overvalued and bide our time in cash or gold or more defensive businesses. And so I guess it's in the absence of the clairvoyant actually coming into my office, and if you meet one, please send him my way, I'm just going to take advantage of volatility after the fact.
You know, I'm wondering what Warren Buffett is thinking as we are speaking. He has more than a little cash, evidently waiting for an opportunity that the market at present valuations is not affording him. You must have observed the Berkshire Hathaway cash balance and wondered whether Warren Buffett himself, no mean thinker about coming events, how he was thinking about risk in the context of current valuations and position anyway. So does that cash balance at Berkshire give you pause about being, I think you're fully invested, right? Yeah.
We have some cash.
Yeah, but mostly for
we have gold.
Yeah.
You know, between a cash and gold, it's plus or minus 20% of the portfolio.
Yeah.
That represents deferred purchasing power for us. And I think if you look at where we're invested as well, our largest sectoral exposure, and we're very diverse within that, is consumer staples. And many of these businesses, I feel, is almost safer than sovereigns because they're across many jurisdictions.
Yeah.
They provide higher real yields. And so it's a question of what is money, what is cash. But yeah, I take your point about Warren Buffett. And in fact, you know, when we were in various investment forums, having discussions with other investors or with clients, I actually pointed out several times last year Warren Buffett's willingness to sell some of his Apple and to wait patiently in cash. It was first time in a while that the cash yield was above wage inflation in the economy. We'd forgotten what that felt like, given that we'd been in a zero interest rate environment for a long time. And you're in a geopolitical environment where a company like Apple, as great as it is quite dependent on a supply chain in a region where geopolitical hostilities were growing. And so, perhaps he sensed idiosyncratic risk. I think perhaps he sensed just valuation risk in general. I think he's favored historic, really looking at the value of equity markets versus GDP. And and stocks certainly looked pretty fully valued on those metrics. And so I think he's willing to patiently bide his time. And I guess maybe there are other motivational dimensions for Warren Buffett. And I think he keeps his cards close to his chest. But, maybe he's, as he's thinking after the passing of Charlie, he's thinking about the long term of Berkshire Hathaway. Perhaps having a more liquid balance sheet for the future is something that makes sense to him. I don't know. I can't get inside his mind totally, but I think it was probably a combination of those motivations. And I think, his prudence has been rewarded, and perhaps his patience will be rewarded too in a couple of quarters.
You have rewarded our listeners, Matt McLennan. Thank you. It was great to talk to you. Matt McLennan, CFA, co-head of the value team and portfolio manager at First Eagle, and a native of Rabaul, Papua New Guinea. Thank you for being with us. It has been terrific. Evan, ditto, thank you. Talk to you soon. Harrison, much obliged to you. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Jim Grant, on behalf of Current Yield, talk to you soon and see you soon at our Tuesday, April 29th Distressed Investing Event.